I want to start with her quote. You can try and figure out who said this. Today, on the continent of Africa, nearly 30 million people have the AIDS virus, including 3 million children under the age of 15. There are whole countries in Africa where more than one-third of the adult population carries the infection. More than 4 million require immediate treatment. Yet across that continent, only 50,000 AIDS victims, only 50,000, are receiving the medicine they need. AIDS can be prevented. Antiretroviral drugs can extend life for many years, and the cost of those drugs has dropped from $12,000 a year to under $300 a year, which places a tremendous possibility within our grasp. Ladies and gentlemen, seldom has history offered a greater opportunity to do so much for so many. This nation can lead the world in sparing innocent people from a plague of nature, and this nation is leading the world in confronting and defeating the man-made evil of international terrorism. So this was George Bush in his State of the Union address in January of 2003 in the lead-up to the war in Iraq. He announced his plan for a new AIDS fund, and then he built his case for the war against Iraq. And I think there's more of a connection between these two than just a humanitarian cover for a barbaric war. Bush calls AIDS a plague of nature, but I want to argue that the same economic and political forces that have given us the Iraq War have also been driving the AIDS pandemic and the responses to it. So what I want to do is review the historical context in which AIDS emerged, and then the past 25 years of theory and practice towards AIDS prevention and treatment. And I want to start with the origin of Western interest in third world diseases, which is tropical medicine. And the discipline of tropical medicine emerged 100 years ago in the context of the scramble for Africa. And it was intimately linked to the acquisition of colonies. And I want to quote a British scientist who argued the case for tropical medicine in an article published in the Indian Medical Gazette in 1921. Said, so long as London remains the focus of the world's commerce and the nerve center of a great tropical empire, it is an imperial necessity that there should be in the metropolis an institution where the study and treatment of tropical diseases can adequately be carried out. Upon nothing so much as upon bodily vigor does tropical colonization depend on for its success. It is the basis of pioneer work in the exploration of uncharted regions in search of oil and other minerals, and in the transformation of a jungle land into rubber plantations and tea gardens and the cultivation of other tropical commodities. It is indispensable alike to the missionary, to the soldier, and to the official who in isolated regions executes the functions of British government. So quite clear. But this project of tropical medicine had an underlying contradiction, which is that colonialism had greatly propagated a lot of these diseases that they were supposedly concerned about. But at that point in history, directly holding colonies was, as the scientists had stated, an imperial necessity. So the dilemma was how to contain the diseases without changing the profitable context. And tropical medicine reflected this contradiction by trying to cure the diseases while ignoring the conditions that spread them. So the guiding ideology was one of biological reductionism, reducing diseases down to purely microbes and focusing it exclusively on medicine. Now, as capitalism developed, the economic division of the world fused with the geopolitical, and the competition between capitals drove competition between states, giving two world wars. And it was really in the Second World War that you had a real big growth and interdependence of the pharmaceutical companies with their states. The United States looked to Pfizer to mass-produce penicillin for the first time to help with the war wounds. Roosevelt appointed George Merck, the head of Merck, to start the biological weapons program in the States. And Nazi Germany looked to their big chemical firm, IG Farben, which Bayer, the producers of aspirin, had joined. So the U.S. emerged from the war the preeminent superpower with half the world's economy and was able to use that power to impose its economic order with the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. In the 1960s and 70s, national liberation movements were able to expel the occupiers, but that didn't put an end to imperialism. Rather, the inter-imperialist rivalry took the form of the Cold War with an economic boom based on massive arms spending, which itself fueled a lot of civil wars around the world, especially in Africa. In fact, decolonization actually coincided with the global shift away from the Third World. Africa, which has been the center of inter-imperialist conflict 100 years ago, now accounts for only 0.6% of foreign direct investment. And this shift has included the pharmaceutical companies. Now Africa is only 1% of their market. So the whole discipline of tropical medicine has been abandoned, and the last major malaria development was actually by the U.S. military in Vietnam. And this economic shift has been paralleled by an ideological shift in the whole theory of tropical medicine. It used to be biological reductionism, reducing intervention just to medicine, and now it's flipped to the other extreme of public health behaviorism that dismisses medicine outright and preaches lifestyle changes and development along the neoliberal model. And these are actually two sides of the same coin, reducing epidemics to the interaction between one individual and one microbe, while ignoring the material context that influences both of them. And so it was in this economic and ideological environment that AIDS first appeared in 1981. And the focus on prevention and lifestyle change was especially strengthened in the U.S. by the backlash against the social movements. Like Hurricane Katrina, the Christian right said that AIDS was God's punishment for gays. But it wasn't just right-wing religious views that had this. In fact, homophobia was firmly enshrined within secular scientific theories. For the first year, AIDS was actually called GRID, which stood for the gay-related immune deficiency. And scientists actually dismissed ideas that it was infectious and argued and said that it was a lifestyle disease spread by gay promiscuity. And this was in any sort of major medical text that you look at in 1981, you know, the Journal of the American Medical Establishment, New England Journal of Medicine, The Lancet, any of them. And so the dominant medical theories clearly reflected a capitalist ideology that makes a rigid distinction between heterosexual and homosexual, classifying one as normal, the other as abnormal. And the growth and professionalization of the medical establishment has seen it assume an ideological role to buttress the dominant ideas. Homosexuality went from being a crime to being a pathology. Now, initially, it was seen as a psychiatric disease, and it was listed in the DSM-IV text, the big text that psychiatrists use, contained homosexuality, until the early 1970s, when the gay liberation movement was able to force it out of the text. And the backlash in the 1980s hijacked AIDS and tried to repathologize homosexuality, this time as a terminal illness. Now, it quickly became clear that AIDS was not confined to gay men, so the name was changed to AIDS, the acquired immunodeficiency syndrome. And the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, changed the theory from a lifestyle disease to a risk group disease. And these four groups were called the four H's. Again, this is conventional medical theory. The four H's are homosexuals, Haitians, heroin users, and hemophiliacs. And these, what were called subgroups, were argued to be monolithic and distinct from the general population and were presented as inherently at risk of an acquired disease. So we reviewed what happened in terms of the backlash against the gay community. In terms of Haitians, they were accused of spreading AIDS through voodoo rituals and exotic sexual behavior. And this discrimination had the impact of, you know, people were expelled from schools. There was, you know, articles in newspapers telling people to fire if they had any Haitian employees. Like, this is a real sort of hysteria. But again, it was codified into official policy. The Food and Drug Administration that controls transfusions put a ban on Haitians from donating blood. In 1987, the U.S. banned all HIV-positive immigrants and refugees, a policy that persists today. And if we have any illusions in Canada's policy, while we don't ban everyone with HIV, anybody who's applying to be a permanent resident has a ban. And in the early 90s, after the first coup against Aristide, Haitian refugees found to be HIV positive were incarcerated in a military prison in Guantanamo Bay, much like what's happening now with people who are perceived as security threats due to their background. Now, as gay men, drug users, and Haitians were being blamed, women were being totally ignored, though not obviously by the virus itself. The first report of a woman with AIDS came in August 1981, so only 2 months after AIDS first appeared. And by 1991, AIDS was the number one cause of death in young women in the U.S. But still by that time, the actual clinical definition of AIDS didn't include a single condition specific to women. And this resulted in many women being excluded from receiving medicine, services, and disability benefits. But this was also a time of intense activism by people with AIDS and their allies. In 1981, the Gay Men's Health Crisis formed to provide services and demanded government research. In 1983, a group of people with AIDS issued the Denver Declaration, which is a disability rights approach to HIV/AIDS. And they argued, quote, "We condemn attempts to label us as victims, a term which implies defeat, and we are only occasionally patients, a term which implies passivity, helplessness, and dependence upon the care of others. We are people with AIDS. In 1987, ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, was formed for direct action to expose government apathy and pharmaceutical prices. The Haitian community and their allies mobilized with rallies against the blood ban and the risk group categorization, including a demonstration of 50,000 people in New York City who held signs saying, "Proud of our blood," and "FDA equals the Federal Discrimination Agency." And this was successful. The CDC removed Haitians as a risk group. The FDA dropped the ban. Then Haitians in the HIV prison in Guantanamo Bay went on a hunger strike, and there was solidarity hunger strikes across campuses across the U.S. There was demonstrations by groups like BAM, the Black AIDS Mobilization, and these, along with the legal challenge, succeeded in closing down the prison. Meanwhile, women demonstrated with the slogan, "Women don't get AIDS, they only die from it," and demanded that the definition actually include conditions specific to women, and when, such as invasive cervical cancer. And when this happened in 1993, it uncovered the true statistics, as in 1 year, the number of women with AIDS tripled. So people with AIDS and their allies had provided prevention and education services for those with AIDS, fought for and succeeded in changing medical theory and practice, and pressured governments and companies into research and drug development. In 1987, the first drug was on the market, AZT, or zidovudine, which prolonged life and dramatically reduced the transmission from women to their infants. In 1996, there was a groundbreaking triple therapy, the drug cocktails, that's now the standard of care. And this has changed AIDS, at least for those who are able to access the medicine, from a death sentence into a chronic disease. So that was 1996. This is 10 years later. So now we know how to prevent AIDS. We have the technology to treat it. And now 10 years later, more people are infected with HIV and more people are dying from AIDS than in any previous year in the 25-year history of AIDS. So I think clearly we have to question what the prevailing approach is to prevention and treatment. So though many still talk about risk groups, one being if you go to the Health Canada website and look at what the risk groups are for AIDS, they now have an expanded list which includes Aboriginals, men who have sex with men, intravenous drug users, youth, and women. So the majority of people, in other words, a majority of subgroups that actually comprise the majority of the population. Despite that, the sort of dominant theory is one of risk behaviors, and specifically that risky sexual behavior spreads AIDS. And so the theory is that prevention has to focus on educating people to avoid these activities. And this theory rests on three set of assumptions that I think explain why it's been so ineffective in preventing AIDS. Firstly, the concept of risk. Secondly, the focus on individual behavior. And thirdly, the reduction to sex. So first of all, what's risky? Well, there's a high risk of transmission of HIV when women don't have control over when, with whom, and under what conditions they have sex. And when people in general don't have access to health care, when people don't have access to AIDS drugs, there's more virus in the body that can be transmitted. And when people have untreated other sexual transmitted diseases, this provides an easier route for HIV to enter the body. But clearly neither of these are behaviors. They're all conditions that are imposed by poverty, racism, and sexism. Now instead, what's been defined as risky has been promiscuity and, in general, gay sex, which is itself portrayed as more promiscuous and more dangerous. And sometimes this can actually assume it can take on a sort of progressive cover that can sometimes be progressives who argue these sorts of things. There's a book called The Political Economy of AIDS, which is fantastic in denouncing the neoliberal policies in Africa. But when they actually try and explain how these on a individual level spread AIDS, this is what they say. They say, "Homosexual behavior is believed to be common in the segregated compounds in which workers live in South African mines. Although the extent of this practice is yet to be determined, homosexual activity appears to play an important role in increasing the risk of HIV infection among minors and their heterosexual partners." So gay sex is portrayed basically as an unhealthy extension of globalization that threatens men and women. Now, promiscuity, or multiple partners, is also characterized as in itself inherently unsafe. But just brings up the question, just basic logic, how is serial monogamy any safer? How does marriage confer protection against HIV? Rather than focus on how to prevent the transmission of a virus, the focus is on regulating normal sexuality within the confines of the nuclear family, claiming that anything other than heterosexuality and celibacy is not only abnormal, but also a public health risk. And the supposed solution is to prevent these behaviors rather than make them and every other expression of sexuality safe. The second assumption is on individual behavior. Now, clearly safe sex is crucial, but this can't be achieved if it's conceived as a lifestyle choice. This theory is a reflection of neoliberal ideology of personal responsibility that exalts the role of the individual but is ultimately disempowering. By ignoring the material factors that influence the ability to make choices, this theory often leads to blame. I'm going to quote from an excellent anthology called Women, Poverty, and AIDS. And they say, "What many of the dominant myths and mystifications have in common is an exaggeration of personal agency, often through highlighting certain psychological or cultural attributes, even though it is not at all clear that these attributes are in any way related to women's risk for HIV infection. Condoms are a classic case in point. As noted, several studies have revealed that most U.S. women at high risk of HIV infection are already aware that condoms can prevent transmission, but many of these women are unable to insist that they be used. Condoms were less likely to be used by couples in which the woman was dependent upon her male partner for rent money. There's nothing wrong with underlying personal agency, but there is something unfair about using personal agency as a basis for assigning blame while simultaneously denying those blamed the opportunity to exert agency in their lives." And this can be particularly stigmatizing for women in the sex trade, and there's a long history of repression that follows blame, including mass quarantine of sex workers during both world wars in the U.S. who were accused of harboring and spreading syphilis. And this is similar to the stigmatization of people addicted to drugs. Now, IV drug use in itself does not spread AIDS, but conditions that force people to reuse needles does. And in both cases, criminalizing these behaviors has only made them more risky, while leaving intact the socioeconomic context that gives rise to them. Public health campaigns that focus exclusively on individual behavior can at worst encourage repression, and at best take a paternalistic approach that sees people as targets of intervention, that's a big word, we have to look at targets of intervention, rather than subjects of their own agency. On the other hand, community-based AIDS prevention campaigns that focus on empowerment offer a dramatically different view of prevention. In 1991, a group of women working on AIDS prevention in Haiti published a text that discusses common myths about women with AIDS. And I want to read three of them, because even 15 years later, I think these are incredibly relevant and actually seem professionally new. And I think this gives an insight as to why the prevailing theories have been so ineffective in halting AIDS. So number one, the myth that women's promiscuity causes AIDS, to which they reply, "Most women with AIDS do not have multiple sexual partners. They have never used IV drugs. They have not received tainted blood transfusions. Their major risk factor is being poor. For others, the risk is being married and unable to control not only their husbands, but also what jobs their husbands have to perform to make a living." Number two, the myth that women are AIDS vectors, to which they reply, "Women are too often perceived as agents of transmission who infect men and innocent babies. Prostitutes have been particularly hard hit by such propaganda, where prostitutes are far more vulnerable to infection than to infecting. AIDS is an occupational risk of commercial sex work, especially in settings in which sex workers cannot safely demand their clients use condoms." And number three, condoms as a panacea, to which they reply, "Gender inequality calls into question the utility of condoms in a setting in which women's ability to insist on safe sex is undermined by a host of less easily confronted forces. Furthermore, many HIV-positive women choose to conceive children, which means a barrier method that prevents conception is not the answer for many. Women-controlled viricidal preventive strategies are necessary if women's wishes are to be respected." And the fact that 15 years later, we still don't have a microbicide on the market, which is a method for women themselves to actually halt the transmission of HIV. The fact that we still don't have that 15 years later, I think, is a real indictment of the pharmaceutical industry, of the whole approach to AIDS prevention. The third assumption behind the theory of risky sexual behavior is a narrow focus on sexual behavior. And this creates a problem, which is how you actually explain the distribution of AIDS between and within countries. 90% of people with AIDS live in developing or undeveloped nations. 70% of them live in sub-Saharan Africa. And the second highest prevalence outside of sub-Saharan Africa is in Haiti. Meanwhile, in the West, the rates of HIV/AIDS is predominantly among people of color. Now, this clearly doesn't have any sort of relationship with promiscuity, with sexual behavior. This overlaps fundamentally with poverty, oppression, and the denial of health care. Now, saying that AIDS is exclusively a sexually transmitted disease and focusing on sexual behavior exclusively would be like saying that cholera, the waterborne disease, is because of people's drinking behavior. And that we have to educate people not to drink from dirty water. And this clearly doesn't explain the outbreak of cholera in South Africa after water privatization, or in Iraq after sanctions and war. Or this would be like blaming tuberculosis on people's risky breathing behavior, and telling people you should really avoid the number of conversation partners you have. Now, this clearly doesn't explain why tuberculosis exploded in Europe during the development of capitalism, when millions of people were forced off the land and into unsanitary living conditions. And it also doesn't explain how TB declined in Europe after rising living standards that accompanied working class struggle. So clearly the targets for intervention should be people's collective living conditions that place people at risk. But instead, the dominant medical ideology has provided a cover for capitalism, and prevention instead targets people's sexuality, psychology, or race. Paul Farmer, the renowned physician and AIDS activist in Haiti, has stated that increasingly what people with AIDS share are not personal or psychological attributes. They do not share culture or language or a certain racial identity. They do not share sexual preference or an absolute income bracket. What they share, rather, is a social position, the bottom rung of the ladder in inegalitarian societies. Now, at the same time as neoliberalism was lecturing people on risky behavior, it was busy spreading a risky context. Structural adjustment policies were first imposed on Africa in 1981, the same year that AIDS emerged. And while they didn't cause the epidemic, obviously, they have provided a context for it to explode. Whole economies have been subordinated to debt, including their health care. One example is Rwanda, about whom apparently the West cares a lot these days in terms of responsibility to protect and all this sort of language. They actually spend three times on debt repayment what they spend on health. So it gives an idea of the priorities of the West. And amongst other things, lack of health funds have actually prevented countries from screening blood transfusions for HIV. And this creates an especially greater risk for women who have higher needs for transfusions in settings where there's not safe and legal access to abortion or to prenatal care, resulting in more needs for more hemorrhages, more needs for transfusions, and more risk for HIV transmission. Another factor has been the mass layoffs of health workers. And even the World Health Organization described this lasting legacy, although in quite diplomatic terms. In many countries, health sector reform under structural adjustment has capped public sector employment and limited investment in public healthcare worker education, thus drying up the supply of young graduates. There are currently 57 countries with a critical shortage, equivalent to a global deficit of 2.4 million doctors, nurses, and midwives. The proportional shortfalls are greatest in sub-Saharan Africa. And paradoxically, these insufficiencies often coexist in a country with large numbers of unemployed health professionals. Poverty, imperfect private labor markets, lack of public funds, bureaucratic red tape, and political interference produce this paradox of shortages in the midst of underutilized talent. But this is presented as cost-effective. It's not that this care disappears, but that it's transferred onto the backs of individuals as unpaid labor done by family members, primarily women. In a further quest for efficiency, the World Bank has imposed user fees. And in the early 80s, they argued that, quote, when a service costs money, people will think twice about demanding it, unquote. And that's exactly what's happened. In fact, when Kenya was forced to impose user fees, the attendance at STD clinics dropped by 65%. And we know that having untreated STDs increases the risk of transmitting HIV. But being in a country which has user fees imposed upon it is not considered a high-risk behavior. Finally, the most recent and well-known neoliberal policy to exacerbate AIDS has been the denial of life-saving treatment imposed by international patent law. In 1999, 39 of the largest pharmaceutical companies sued South Africa for attempting to import generic AIDS drugs. And to justify this false dichotomy between prevention and treatment, Africa was accused of a lack of infrastructure, lack of personnel, lack of resources. And first of all, none of these are appropriate excuses to denial of treatment, and especially in settings, especially Haiti now is actually a model of places which, despite all these impacts of neoliberalism, still with medicine can make big changes in health. And secondly, all of these are actually a result of following structural adjustment policies. As well, Africa has been accused of not being able to take medicine properly. And at one point, the head of U.S. aid actually said that Africans don't know what Western time is and that they wouldn't be able to follow medicine regimens. Now, companies were concerned about their markets in Africa, which account for only 1%. And most of the companies who were part of the lawsuit don't even make AIDS drugs. But what they were concerned about was the domino effect, the wider implications of what this would mean if Western consumers, patients, people, started demanding similarly affordable prices. So corporations tried to create global divisions between these sets of people. They argued not only that providing medicine would not work, but also that it would be dangerous. In one article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, they said that providing AIDS medicine would turn third world into a petri dish for new resistant strains, and also that it would undermine new drug development. But a mass campaign emerging as part of the anti-globalization movement fought back against the lawsuit and showed clearly that the real issue is human lives versus profit. The campaign was led by the TAC, the Treatment Action Campaign, which is the united front of people with AIDS, other activists, healthcare workers, and the major trade unions like COSATU. And it was co-founded by incredibly inspiring activist Zaki Akhmat, an anti-apartheid gay rights activist and person living with AIDS, who in 1999 went on the world's first drug strike by refusing to accept treatment until it was provided for everyone. The mass campaign against the lawsuit garnered international support. MSF, the Médecins Sans Frontières, had a petition which received 285,000 signatures from people across 130 countries. And there was demonstrations on streets and campuses around the world with the motto, people not profit and patients not patents. And they won. This is people with AIDS in the most impoverished, most, receiving the most brutal economic policies, fought back and won against the most powerful pharmaceutical corporations in the world. As Zaki Akhmat declared, together with our allies, Médecins Sans Frontières and ACT UP, Oxfam and many other international organizations, we've challenged the giants, Pfizer, GlaxoSmithKline, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Abbott, and Roche. We will never forget that millions of people have died and will continue to die because they profiteer from medicines. They have blood on their hands. And the TAC showed that whether in a court case in Pretoria, on the streets of Sao Paulo, or Calcutta, or New York, this was a battle to stop a holocaust against the poor. Now, these pharmaceutical corporations have taken their policies to an absurd level. We have the top five companies are worth twice the combined gross national product of all of sub-Saharan Africa. Many of these drugs, including AZT, the first, were actually developed with public funds, and yet they're owned, they're hoarded away in private hands. And many of the drugs were actually tested on people in Africa, and yet the actual final product is being denied from the very same people. But the fundamental nature of the pharmaceutical industry, I think, just follows the basic principles of the market, which is you go where the profit is. Unprofitable diseases are ignored. So in the past generation, only 1% of new drugs have been for third world diseases. Meanwhile, profitable markets have incredible redundancy. Each company has to produce their own version of the same drug to capture these small markets. So 2/3 of new drugs in the past generation have in fact offered no therapeutic advantage. Then, once they each have their own version of the drug, they have to find a way to capture a market. So they spend 3 times on advertising, what they do on research. They engage in price wars, and the most recent and notorious has been a drug called Norvir, which again was developed with public funds, but is now owned by Abbott Laboratories, one of the big giants. And this is a drug which is used in combination with drugs from a lot of other countries, or from a lot of other companies. And so now Abbott has its own combination, and it wants to drive people away from using Norvir and the others to its own combination. So what does it do? Is December 3rd, 2003, 2 days after World AIDS Day, they quadrupled the price of Norvir in order to drive patients away from the competitors and toward the new combination. Finally, what companies do is they look to the connections that they have with their home state. Now, pharmaceutical companies, as with all multinationals, can give the appearance of being stateless firms that roam around the world in search of cheap investment, while nation states wither in the face of a global empire of capital. And while it's true that corporations have greatly expanded beyond their borders, the bulk of their investment is actually still within the imperial powers. 90% of global pharmaceutical production is within industrialized countries. And what's more, they're especially concentrated and interdependent with their home state, just as they were in the Second World War. For example, in Britain, the two biggest firms, Glaxo Wellcome and SmithKline Beecham, each a product of a previous merger of four British pharmaceutical companies, came together a few years ago to make GlaxoSmithKline the largest firm behind U.S.'s Pfizer. In France, the two biggest French firms, Sofino and Aventis, have come together in a merger of mergers to produce France's major pharmaceutical company, and a deal which was actually pushed by the French government. If we look at the top 50 pharmaceutical corporations, we see that each one is actually nationally based. And what's more is that the picture is not overwhelmingly American. I should see that in the top 50, there's 20 American, 17 European, and 12 Japanese companies. And this is actually a reflection of the global economy in general. Though massive arms spending sustained the U.S. economy through the Second World War and through the Cold War, over time it's actually allowed its competitors to invest in actual productive industries like pharmaceuticals. The U.S. economy is in relative decline with emerging rivals in Europe and Asia, but what it's left with is a massive military power. Now, in the lead-up to the war in Iraq, some people argued that protesting against the war would be a distraction from economic issues, but these are actually two sides of the same coin. I want to quote from the British activist and Marxist Chris Harman, arguing why the U.S. War in Iraq was so important for the U.S. economy in general. He said, increased military capacity would ensure that the rest of the world accepted policies beneficial to U.S. corporations. Acceptance of U.S. rules on patents and intellectual copyright, which is so important to the software and pharmaceutical companies, the setting of global oil prices to suit U.S. interests, the continued domination by U.S. firms of the international arms trade, and the opening up of foreign markets to U.S. goods. The war against Iraq fitted into this by providing a chance to demonstrate the sheer level of U.S. military power and to increase control of the world's number one raw material and Europe's source of oil. The war, then, was part of a wider strategy of using U.S. military power to compensate for relative economic decline over many years. The aim was to so reinforce U.S. global hegemony as to make other countries accept U.S. policies when it comes to the IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO. And they've shown their interest in precisely doing that, using the war to advance economic policies. So Paul Wolfowitz, one of the chief architects of the war, is now the head of the World Bank. Tommy Thompson, the former U.S. Secretary of Health and Services, was elected the head of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. And now Bush has started his own plan, which he announced in 2003, called PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. Now, the Bush administration is not only filled with oil executives, but also pharmaceutical executives. Bush Sr. was a director of Eli Lilly, one of the U.S. big giants. Rumsfeld was first CEO of J.D. Searle, which is bought up by Pfizer, and then became chairman of the board of Gilead, which collects royalties on Tamiflu, which is the drug presented as a cure for avian flu. So Rumsfeld would directly profit from the $1 billion that the U.S. has invested into Tamiflu for flu prevention. And now Randall Tobias, the former CEO of Eli Lilly, has been made head of this new AIDS fund. So I wonder what the priorities will be. And about they're quite clear on all the strings attached to these funds. There's ideological strings. So a third of the funds for prevention have to go for abstinence-only education, if it can be called education. And recipients must explicitly condemn prostitution. Secondly, there's economic strings, which is that countries can only use the funds to buy brand-name drugs. And secondly, there's also a push to actually for them to actually accept GMO foods as well, just to throw that in the mix. Now, there's been an obvious outcry against this, and at the last International AIDS Conference, hundreds of activists heckled Randall Tobias. And remarkably, another one of the hecklers was actually French President Jacques Chirac, who openly accused in a letter the U.S. of blackmail. Now, like the war in Iraq, the movement has helped to expose imperial rivals. As the head of the European delegation stated at the AIDS conference, there is a danger that the United States would go into major bilateral trade agreements that don't follow the agreements we've all made. So, like the rift over Iraq, the concern is not for human needs, but for corporate markets. And there's been a remarkable turnaround in just the past few years over the issue of treatment from the very same people who argued vigorously against it. Instead of saying that Africans can't tell time, the U.S. is now pushing for medicine. The G8 in the last G8 summit promised universal access to AIDS drugs by 2010, a position that's now actually supported by the World Bank. Now, activism by people with AIDS and their allies has clearly played a role in pushing this. This would never have happened without decades and decades and decades of struggle. But there's also other reasons that the imperial powers have a supposed interest for AIDS. As the World Bank wrote last year, quote, in many countries, AIDS has reversed the development achievements of the past generation and now jeopardizes the prospects of the next. In some countries in sub-Saharan Africa, AIDS has slashed life expectancy in half. It has closed schools and overwhelmed healthcare services. So again, treating AIDS as a purely biological process clearly serves as a cover for a whole generation of economic policies that have served to amplify it. And in some respects, I think this is a return to the original ideology of tropical medicine that reduces diseases to microbes. And at least in one area, there actually is a new scramble for Africa. 70% of U.S. Imports from Africa are oil, and the U.S. actually gets more oil from Africa than they do from Saudi Arabia. And now with all the conflict in the Middle East, they're keen to diversify to other sources. But the main concern for the imperial powers is actually the spread of AIDS beyond Africa. As the American Enterprise Institute explained in 2002, Africa's AIDS catastrophe is a humanitarian disaster of world historic proportions, yet the economic and political reverberations from this crisis have been remarkably muted outside the continent itself. The explanation for this awful dissonance lies in the region's marginal status in global economics and politics. But in the three largest countries, China, India, and Russia, the coming Eurasian pandemic threatens to derail the economic prospects of billions and alter the global military balance. So that's their concern, the connection between AIDS and imperialism. And exposing these links can also help build our movement for a better world. In June of 2004, the Treatment Action Campaign in South Africa called for a global day of action against U.S. militarism and underfunding of AIDS, declaring that the effects of the U.S. government's unlawful war in Iraq has been to divert international attention and resources away from global health and poverty. Hundreds of billions of dollars are being spent on the military instead of investing resources in the biggest threats to human security today, HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, malnutrition, and poverty. So we're 1 year since Live AIDS, and still the Global Fund for AIDS, its demand of $10 billion, has not been met. Bush gave for 1 year what the U.S. military spends in 1 day. And the $300 billion Iraq war, that $300 billion could completely erase all of Africa's debt. When it comes to Canada, the government gave only $140 million. So Harper has just given 10 times that for security, for beefing up border control. And last year, Martin gave 100 times that for the military budget. So Canada could have completely paid for the entire global fund, but chose instead to invest in war and occupation. Now last year, the anti-war movement joined the Make Poverty History campaign with the slogan, Fight Poverty, Not War. And the links made between these two movements can strengthen both of them by expanding both their numbers and also broadening their perspective. And this August in Toronto, there will be the 16th International AIDS Conference, and we have a similar opportunity of linking anti-war with anti-globalization and to demand access for all, drop the debt, and stop the war. Thank you.